Hello listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. I am your speaker Casey, and for this week's instalment of Jehovah's Witnesses Month, we are going to be speaking to Luke from Wales in the UK. Before we get started, I just wanted to mention my Patreon. You can support the podcast from as little as £1 a month at patreon.com/thecultvault. You can also help the podcast by leaving me a review, or if you have an Android phone or device, downloading the Cult Vault podcast app from the Google Play Store. But for now, here is Luke. So hi Luke, and thank you so much for joining me today. I've been emailing you for a while now, and we've had a really long conversation backwards and forwards, and now I get to speak to you in person. Can you please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, where you are, and what you're up to today?
Hello! Hello everyone. My name's Luke. I'm 24 years old. And I live in sunny South Wales. And if you knew South Wales, you knew it's not sunny. I was born into a big family, with me being the second youngest out of six children. We moved out of Redditch into mid Wales when I was only small. So I've stayed in Wales the majority of my life, kind of Brecon Beacons, Llandrindod area, really much.
Okay. And what are you doing now at 24 years old?
At 24 years, I'm now moved down to South Wales. I'm now a full-time lorry driver, which is exhausting, to say the least. But I'm actually studying. I'm actually studying at university towards a course and hopefully a future career.
Fantastic. So does your lorry driving take you outside of Wales?
Oh, it takes me everywhere. And I only wish I could tell you where, because I don't know half the time myself. I drive and I just follow and go where I need to be.
I've written here in my notes that you weren't always a Jehovah's Witness. You weren't born into the religion. So just tell us a little bit about how you found yourself a practicing Jehovah's Witness.
Right. Before we go on, I think I need to mention what the word willing means inside of a cult. And right. I'm sure you understand this from the many interviews and research that you've done. But if you're in a cult or an organization, where you have to be willing to do something, otherwise there will be consequences. It's not really a willing mm-hmm. thing to do. There's nothing willing about do this or there will be adverse consequences. And I thought I'd get that out first, because a lot of stuff in the organization is done willingly by its members.
Right.
But there's always a case where if you don't, of course, the consequences is eternal death.
Yeah.
So this organization is very much run on a fear basis, where you could stand to lose everything or gain anything, if you say so. It mostly targets people who are vulnerable, people who have either had problems or some sort of emotional discomfort with maybe a loss of a loved one. That's what they try and target, you see.
So at the initial stages of indoctrination, the religion itself is looking for people who are in some sort of period of transition, whether that's grief or soul searching. And were you in one of those positions when you found yourself starting to look at the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yeah, well, both my parents are what we witnesses call as first generation. They weren't brought up in the truth. They themselves came into the truth.
Oh, right.
They were knocked on the door. My mother was contacted, had a Bible study. She got talking and comfortable to the witnesses. She brought my dad into it. So that's what we call a first generation family. And of course, they raise their children to be in the truth, and there will be second gen and third gen. So I'm from a first gen family. Unfortunately, half my family didn't really take to it. My sisters didn't really want to be inside of the cult. They saw it quite restrictive. Mm-hmm. So did my younger brother. But my oldest brother, he really took to it. There are reasons behind why he really took to it, which I can't really talk about because they're quite personal.
Okay.
But he soon became a ministerial servant, a regular pioneer. He became an elder, and he's the one who brought me into it. He wanted me to grow up with the same standards and to come to know into the organisation, so I was invited round his to study regularly.
Okay, so you're familiar with the doctrine and the practice of the witnesses. It's your brother that brings you more seriously into worshipping Jehovah.
Yes, unfortunately, my family were, especially my parents, became inactive as Jehovah's Witnesses due to health reasons pretty early on. My mum suffers from a lot of mental health. My dad, unfortunately, is getting a bit old. And because of these circumstances, they weren't able to make it to all the meetings or commit as seriously as witnesses are expected to commit. So they get classed as inactive.
Right, right. And what age were you when your brother took you under his wing?
I was probably 13 years old.
And what was life like for you at the age of 13?
I'd say it was pretty ordinary, the same as any other young person growing at that time in the area. I was going to school, I had friends, looking at possible careers. I was applying and looking for the best way. I think I was going to college, not going to college, but planning to go to college, mm-hmm. certainly. Just normal.
So at this time in school, if you're at attending a regular school, are you already foregoing celebrations of birthdays, or
oh, yes.
is that something? Okay, so you didn't just take yeah. that more seriously as you got further involved yeah. with the church.
Yeah, even though my parents were both inactive, they still held the same standards as the witnesses. So we were all brought up, of course, basic morals, it's bound to lie and so on, and the belief that there was a God and creator, that his name was Jehovah, how to pray, but also that we don't do birthdays, celebrations, get-togethers, things like that.
And what about other members of your congregation? Were you able to go and do house visits with other children similar to your age?
Initially, I didn't really know anybody inside the congregation because, of course, my parents were inactive. I didn't go. So all my friends extended out towards my school friends. That was my social life. That was what I had. But after being invited and taken under the wing of my brother, as it were, I quickly abandoned those friendships because they were seen as bad association. And my new association became that of the witnesses.
Okay. And what did that look like? How did that transition happen? It started off with going with your brother to one meeting and then progressed. Did it progress fast or was it sort of organic over time?
It was organic over time. I think I studied with my brother for about 1 or 2 years. What impressed me about what he was trying to teach me was that the Bible was scientific. And I'm quite scientifically minded.
Okay.
I'm quite logical and reasonable, and that's how I work things out. So what he told me seemed to impress upon me that this is the truth. This is the only religion which teaches a harmony between scriptural teaching and, of course, scientific understanding. So I got brought into it with that way, but the transition was quite hard because, of course, the expectation of being a Jehovah's Witness, there's a lot of standards you have to meet. And being somebody who didn't really grow up in the organization, I felt at quite a disadvantage. I didn't have parents who brought me up correctly. I wasn't always at the meetings. I had worldly or bad friends. It felt very much that I was living two different lifestyles. I was being like almost a split personality. I was going to school being this one person, but then when I was with my brother, I had to be somebody else, and that was very hard.
Did you feel like there was ever a moment where you had to choose one or the other?
Oh, yes, all the time. And of course, I was determined to make the organization my life.
And why do you think that was?
It was stressed upon me that this is the truth and everything else is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about in depth on how the world is supposedly controlled by Satan, as well as all of its media, and how everything is designed to take you away from that truth. So I became very skeptical of everything, but not the truth. It was affirmed to me that it was the truth, unquestionable. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it just happened that way.
And you've got a brother that you admire and you look up to, and he's given you this information and he's telling you that this is what he knows to be true. So you don't doubt anything that he's teaching you.
Oh, no, he was the guy who taught me how to shave, he was. He taught me how to make a cup of tea. We're talking about the person who really stepped in the position of my parents and mentored me, both in physical hygiene, how to grow up, you know, just simple things. But also he was my tutor for being in the truth as well, for being, well, it's not the truth, okay, but he became my Bible study conductor, as it were.
And you talked about standards that you were supposed to uphold to be a devout, as devout as possible as a Jehovah's Witness. Can you give us some examples of what those standards might look like?
It all comes down to the one principle on how to be a Jehovah's Witness, and that is give everything. So in order to be a Jehovah's Witness, you must be prepared to give everything, because it is what they call the truth. It is everything. There's no halfway in between. There's no, okay, I'll give this and not. It's everything. So everything down to your personality traits, everything down to the way you think, feel, and what you do, it all has to be aspirations towards this one organization.
So at the time you become more seriously involved with the church, are your aspirations of going to college sort of pushed to the side?
Not really. It was encouraged by my brother to go to college, right, to learn a skill to then apply to the organization. He wanted me to learn some sort of trade like carpentry or become an electrician. That way I could serve better in the organization with building kingdom halls or doing projects or become some sort of use to the organization.
Okay, and it's my understanding that that's quite universal across Jehovah's Witnesses throughout the world. Is that also your understanding?
I think it's regional to the level and extent of your education, because of course I was encouraged by my brother to go to college and, you know, learn a trade, but mm-hmm. then again the elders in the congregation discouraged me from doing it. Now I was at the point where my application was in, it was accepted, I had had an open day, I'd even sorted out rent and accommodation, I was all ready to go, but yet the elders talked me out of going to college because apparently it is quite a worldly environment and it would lead me astray. So I wrote in a letter of cancellation and I left college.
And what was the elders' recommendation instead of college?
To make spiritual pursuits my career.
Okay, does this include things like pioneering?
Oh yeah, definitely. Pioneering is an extremely admirable goal inside the organisation, as well as applying things for special forms of service.
Okay, so after you became more seriously involved with the Witnesses, what did an average day and week within the church look like for you?
Oh, average day. I guess it depends on what week you're talking about, because there's no such thing as average with right. Jehovah's Witnesses. That's because there's something always going on. We have major events like assemblies twice a year. We all have to gather and listen to spiritual programming. Conventions once a year, we've got annual general meetings and their recordings, CO visits, we've got special pioneering arrangements, memorial weeks, campaigns. They're all planned out throughout the year, so you're always doing something or keeping your mind active. But if nothing was going on, if there was no special event, then of course we go back to the standards, which is your ministry being your priority, try and contact as many people as you can and try and get them in the organization as well. You had your meetings, which was your Sunday meeting, your Thursday meeting, as well as any kind of ministry meetings. You had meditation and personal Bible reading. They were expected to be done every single day as much as you can. Family worship or Bible studies, return visits, social gatherings sometimes, and of course regular special assignments or preparing talks or Bible readings, regular prayer, ministry preparation. And that's not even to touch on special forms of service that were available to some of the exemplary people in the congregation.
So on average, how much time a week do you think you were spending around activities linked to the church?
Every waking moment, I'd say, because if you're not on the ministry and you're not at the meetings, then you should be studying. If you're not studying, you should be in prayer or enjoying wholesome association with other believers. You accept a lifestyle, not just forms of worship.
So you had no hobbies or activities outside of the church at this point?
I did have a few hobbies, but the important thing is to make sure that they are approved by the organization, which is a bit
difficult. So how would you, what types of activities were they, and how would you go about getting those approved?
You had to make sure they're always kept in their appropriate place. We're not supposed to be, if we're not studying, or if we're not doing anything else like meetings and ministry, you need to make sure that it's not blacklisted by the governing body for us, for starters. So things like things that promote violence or things which are a promiscuous nature. And then, of course, you've got to think if it doesn't agree or doesn't get in the way of your spiritual development. So things like your regular Bible study, does it get in the way of that, or does it? Could you be doing more admirable things? And then right. You need to make sure it doesn't make you doubt your beliefs. So, of course, things like higher education or associating with the wrong people, you need to make sure that it doesn't hinder or affect the way that you think. You need to make sure also that it doesn't stumble other people. So some things are a conscience issue within the congregation, but you can't be seen doing something which some other person may find offensive.
Right.
And you need to also make sure that it doesn't give a bad witness to unbelievers. So does anybody who is not a witness, seeing what you're doing, would it affect the way they think about witnesses? Which is very awkward because you always feel that you're always being watched, not just by people inside the organization, but people outside the organization. So you need to make sure you're doing things wholesome all the time. But even then, these choices are grey areas. It may be unwholesome in one way, but usually it's just safer to do what the organization wants you to do.
Right.
Which is just study. Just study, 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 enjoy wholesome association or entertainment, meetings, as much ministry as you can, and that's apparently the perfect way of life, the best way to live.
And I know that Kingdom Halls are universal across the Jehovah's Witnesses. Can you explain to the listeners what your Kingdom Hall looked like specifically?
Very bland. Now, I served in a need greater area.
Right.
And a need greater area is an area where perhaps the territory to cover is quite large, not everyone's getting contacted, and they need preachers. Now, my need greater area was the Brecon Beacons. Huge area, stunning area, but we didn't even have a Kingdom Hall. We actually rented a facility, a property, a hall.
Right.
A school hall. For our daily social, for our weekly associations, we set out speakers and such and all sorts. I think they're still looking for a property to develop a Kingdom Hall at the moment now.
And how did you end up involved in working in a greater need area? Were you already established there, or were you asked to go and work specifically in that area?
No. My home territory, where I originally came from, was a lot more mid Wales towards Llandrindod area.
Okay.
Now, as the next congregation over, their territory was a lot smaller, a lot easier to manage, but I was encouraged to go over to the need greater area, towards the Brecon area, because they weren't being, it was a need greater area and it was admirable.
And this was encouraged by your brother or the elders?
By my brother and by the elders.
Okay. And are you a ministerial servant at this point, or are you just pioneering?
At this point, I was auxiliary pioneering.
Okay.
In high day, and I had ministerial duties. I was what you'd call the assistant's assistant. Unfortunately, the actual ministerial servant that was in charge of literature was blind. So he needed somebody to do everything for him. So it was a way to give me the privilege without officially giving me the privilege.
Okay. And am I right in thinking that you would have to attend Bethel if you wanted to become an official ministerial servant?
You definitely have to have Bethel involved in contacting them, because of course such appointments don't just come from the elders, but they can also come from the CEO's recommendations, which of course is a almost representative of Bethel.
So you wouldn't personally visit Bethel?
I was told to make it a goal. I visited Bethel as a visitor, as a guest, many times. Sometimes we even had congregation trips to see the headquarters. But to actually apply there or to work there was a special set of standards you had to meet.
Okay. And is there like a Bethel in every country, or is there just one headquarters?
Bethel is loosely translated from the Hebrew as House of God, I believe. And it does act as a regional headquarters. Sometimes a large country can have more than one Bethel.
Okay.
But in the case of Britain, we've only got the one.
And where is that located?
It was located in London, as far as I'm concerned. It has recently moved now. I believe it is at, watching the updates, there was a massive build. Think.
Find out. On the jw.org website that I've spent a lot of time reading. It's in Chelmsford.
Chelmsford, thank you. See, I was going to say, Chelmsford. Yes. So the property is at Chelmsford at the moment. That's a new build, that is. Their old headquarters used to be London, or kind of in London. Can't remember exactly where in there.
So you mentioned earlier some special forms of service for congregation members who are in favour with the elders. Can you give us some examples of what those things are?
Yes. We realise in the organisation there is a ladder to climb as a witness. Everybody is expected to be a regular attendant, to be attentive and to answer up regularly. But then you go to being unbaptised, publisher, to a baptised active member of the congregation. But from that point on, you're expected to reach out and climb this ladder higher in terms of special forms of service. So these can include things like pioneering, auxiliary or regular, which is whether you give 50 hours a month in service or 70 hours a month in service, of course, ministerial servants, building and constructing kingdom halls and assemblies, helping out with special arrangements like conventions, Bethel service. Eventually you could reach out to become an elder, then a special pioneer. You can become a missionary, as well as other administrative and managerial roles.
Okay. And you also mentioned something about yourself included, members of the witnesses being sent to different areas. Is it common for a Jehovah's Witness to be sent to a different country, for example?
Not the usual rank and file, but if you were to reach out for a special form of service like missionary or to become a circuit overseer, then yes, you are expected to go where you're told.
Okay, and what about if you were to become qualified in a trade of some type and they needed help to construct a building somewhere other than where you are, would you also be expected to go and help with that?
The old arrangement was called the RBC, which was the Regional Building Committee.
Okay.
That usually consisted of local brothers and sisters who would help locally within a region, but that has now been disbanded. It's now is it International Eld? So many acronyms within the organisation. But now they have organised a devoted construction team which would be sent wherever to construct kingdom halls, even in foreign lands as well.
So there's construction happening all over the world right now, building kingdom halls in most countries?
I wouldn't say all over the world. Of course, in some third world countries, the expansion is quite dramatic. But in first world world, I think it's first world. In more advanced populations, the expansion isn't as dramatic.
Okay, and why do you think that is?
Personally, I think it's the internet. It's easy to do your own research when you have access to the internet. And of course, you only need to type in Google Jehovah's Witnesses to find out exactly what they're about.
And you also mentioned that your brother became an elder within the church. Did he have access to this special book that all the elders get to read?
Yes, he did. I did as well. It's not an uncommon book to have in the hall, and because I was assistant to the literature assistant, I dealt with these books all the time, but I was never allowed to open them or read them. It's forbidden.
Okay, so you did get to see a copy of the book, you just didn't get to read it.
Yes, that's right.
Were you ever tempted to just have a little sneak peek?
No. The witnesses very much teach that their authority is given by God, and to look into these books would be undermining that authority.
Okay, and what do you think is written inside those books?
Personally, I've always thought it was just general procedure and how to handle things and how to do things scripturally.
So not ethically, scripturally, because a couple of other people I've spoken to have suggested that there are protocols within the book on how to deal with fallout within your congregation, for example, or abuse within the congregation. And this is all just speculation from survivors of the Jehovah's Witnesses who say that the elders are very good at covering up inside abuse, and they think that perhaps inside this book there is a way to tell you how to do that.
Of course, while I was in the organization, when I was studying or when I was an active pioneer, I had no doubts in my mind that there was anything malicious going on behind the screens. But of course, we weren't ever allowed to look behind the screen. Now, though, I know this book is freely available online, and I have had a look at it myself, and I have been shocked to see just how dogmatic it really is. It does cover a lot of areas that are quite sensitive, relating to child abuse, or misdemeanors, or even legal actions against kingdom halls, but also the best way to minimalize damage, I think the way it words it, to try and uphold the organization's public face.
And I know that the religion itself overall is very patriarchal in the way that only men can be elders. It's also been mentioned to me that women are encouraged to get jobs such as cooking and cleaning and menial jobs that require small amounts of time throughout the week so that you are still free to give as much of your time to Jehovah as possible while supporting your family financially. So, with that in mind, do you think there'll ever be a time where the Jehovah's Witnesses might see women take leadership roles within the church?
Oh no. That is a very, very big issue in the congregation on where women stand. Women are second class citizens. Jehovah's Witnesses use and abuse and cherry pick scriptures from the Bible to make sure women are always kept in their place. Even leaving it now, I'm beginning to realize just how patriarchal it was. Women aren't allowed to teach from the platform. They are allowed, though, to have places. How do I say? They are allowed to have interviews with each other on the stage, but that's a workaround to try and get them on the stage, but not teaching the congregation, kind of interviewing each other.
Is it seen as a privilege for these women to get the opportunity to do this as well?
Oh, it is a privilege, but even then, the teaching role would not be fit for a woman within the congregation. If a woman was to teach somebody who was a man, she has to wear a head covering. This apparently gives respect to God's arrangement of things. I'm not quite sure how it works, but even if this woman was teaching in the presence of somebody who was unbaptized or even not even in the organization, she is still expected to have a head covering. That's why you'd see Jehovah's Witnesses women on the ministry always wearing hats, because they have to.
Right.
It's a bit silly, I know, when you think about it and
It's
think
just
back.
very it's very, as a woman myself as well, it's aggravating because it almost feels like when you think about how far women's rights and equal rights have come in the last sort of decade or 2 decades, it's almost like talking about something we're reading in a history book as
Well, I think
opposed to what's happening today about women having to wear head coverings that almost keep them
yeah, legal. Yeah, I'll keep them in place either which. What is even stranger though, is that men aren't allowed to wear head coverings when conducting prayers or such like that, because again, that's God's arrangement.
right, okay. And I know that they're
I'll say what's even stranger is that men are expected to have head covering, well, are expected not to wear head coverings when taking the lead or saying prayers. It's completely the opposite to women. It's a strange thing that runs off a scripture, which again is grossly misapplied.
and interpreted probably 1,000 different ways depending on who you speak to.
Most possibly, yes.
So I know that the religion itself is also very man marries woman. They can only, there's no premarital sex allowed. You're not allowed to live together until you're married. You actually have to be chaperoned if you're going to go on a date. I've spoken to a few Jehovah's Witnesses who have since left the movement that have explained their experiences of that with me. Were you ever chaperoned on a date with anybody?
And unfortunately, with the witnesses, it's a priority for people to stay single. It's definitely encouraged because apparently single people can devote more and give more than a married couple. So, as a young person growing up in the organization, I was encouraged not to give marriage or relationships a chance, but to aim as a self-dependent young individual who can go out to special forms of service without the hindrance of a woman.
Okay. And what about the LGBTQIA plus community? Did you know of anybody in your congregation that didn't want to talk about not fitting into the heteronormative storyline?
That's again another very difficult one, because there were, without giving names or subtle hints, there were a few that I knew,
Okay.
but I only ever knew that because the elders like to talk. Unfortunately, the confidentiality within the organization is pretty poor. So you quickly get to know which people who have had dealings or problems or who had certain feelings. The ones I've known have either been marked, or some have left, and one unfortunately had died in a road collision.
And when you say that the confidentiality is lacking within the religion, do you mean that the elders would sit and publicly talk about somebody being a member of the LGBT community?
Well, there's a lot of sexual repression within the organization,
Yeah.
and I think that leads to a lot of people questioning their sexuality or being repressed in one form or way in the way they feel. I myself am pansexual.
Right.
Within the organization, I knew that I had feelings for both men and women. I didn't really think gender should be considered in a relationship. But that made me feel bad. That made me feel really, really bad because, of course, they'd awfully have weekly talks or publications denouncing this sort of thing. So I confessed with the elders that I had these problems and thoughts.
Right.
And of course, their first protocol is to tell every other elder within the congregation. So I confided in one person, And then before I know it, 20 other people are in the know and their wives.
And then it's my understanding as well that the wives occasionally have their own social get-togethers as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's probably likely that the information that you share confidentially is being spoken about at length without your knowledge. Yeah.
There's no confidentiality, even with private things.
And were you ever made aware of other people's confessions that they had made with the elders?
Yes, of course, not directly, but just because elders like to speak.
And were you ever the person that went to the elders with information to almost snitch on other members of the congregation?
Oh, yes. Yeah, oh, yes. There's a big snitching atmosphere within the organisation. We watch over each other. We're told it's a loving thing to do.
That's such a common thing I'm finding within these types of movements, that you're encouraged to spy on one another. So there's never really any level of trust within any of the churches, as far as I can tell. Was your brother made aware of your sexual preferences at this point?
He might have well been. He's never talked to about me.
Okay.
But he had, I think, moved from that congregation to another need greater area before I confessed, I think. So I might have got away with it. I'm not too sure.
Okay. And you felt compelled to confess this to the elders because you were worried about your soul?
Oh, yeah. Of course, one of the main teachings of Jehovah's Witnesses is that life without God's favour is not a life worth living.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's anything that would compromise your favour with God, it must be confessed to the elders, and the elders must deal with it in the appropriate way.
Do you think that the sexual repression within the church is a big factor for people distancing themselves from the movement? Or is it easier for somebody to say I'm a gay woman and I marry a man within the congregation because that's what Jehovah wants and that's the best way to be a committed witness? Is it easier for me to just live in that life that isn't true to myself than it would be to distance myself from the church?
Oh, of course, you should never live a lie to yourself. Mm-hmm. You can't lie to yourself. And to have other people tell you what you should do and how you should believe and how you should feel is wrong.
Do you think that's something that does commonly happen within the witnesses, though?
Oh, definitely, because, of course, there is consequences. There is enforced protocols. If someone were to step out of the line or go out of line, there will be consequences. It's pretty much the majority of any kind of cult. You do what we do, otherwise we hurt you.
Right. And you talk about consequences. I know one of these is the potential of being disfellowshipped. If you were to be disfellowshipped because you are distancing yourself from the witnesses now, does this mean that you're going to lose contact with the brother that you look up to so much?
Yeah, it does.
And is that a difficult decision for you to make then, whether to stay within the church or leave because you don't want the breakdown of this relationship?
Initially it was. It wasn't just about my brother neither. I mean, when I left school, I was told to view my family poorly because they were inactive and to make this new spiritual family my real family. So everybody in the congregation became my brothers, my sisters, uncles, nieces, nephews. They became more than just a group to me. They were my family. They became my social network. My aspirations, all my goals were in this organization. So the prospect of leaving leaves you with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very hard to begin with.
It's difficult as well if the church is encouraging you to almost look down on your family because it's disregarding your mother's ailments at that point, which must be strange for you to think back on now.
It was very strange. I moved out of their care when I was 16 into a house of some other witnesses where they became my other mother and father, as it were.
Right, okay. And what effect do you think that had on your parents?
I really don't know. Of course, they are what we call, think it's POMI, or physically out but mentally in. They believe it's the truth. They believe the organization has the truth, but they can't devote what they want to it. But they
Yes,
can
yep.
see me going to make them proud, as it were, by joining the organization. And even though it's leaving them behind, I'm pursuing a more noble goal. So
Okay.
maybe in one sense they were proud of me, maybe in another sense they weren't. I'm not too sure.
And what's your relationship like with them now?
I've talked to my dad quite extensively about how I feel about the organization, as well as the stuff I've uncovered from it,
Okay.
how they are a cult, and he wants to agree to disagree. But at the same time, I've got to respect their way of beliefs and what they want to believe. And of course, because the headship of every woman is the man, I've left it to him to talk to my mother.
It's very strange to think about you having this conversation with your father as well, because your experience, from the sounds of it, within the witnesses has been completely different to what he has known.
Yeah, it's been completely different. Unfortunately, I was brought in with the assumption that Bible and science work together.
Is that not the case?
Of course, when I was studying with my brother and studying with the witnesses, we weren't allowed to do any kind of academic research or to question certain things. But due to a couple of circumstances, I was able to, and I pretty much see through it now.
Okay, and when you initially said this at the start of our interview, I thought that you meant that they would read scriptures and they wouldn't disregard science, but they would incorporate it into their teachings. So I've obviously misinterpreted what you meant.
No,
So
no.
that didn't happen.
They'll only agree with scientific understanding if it supports their point.
Okay.
So when I say I was impressed that the things they were teaching was from a scientific standpoint, that's them taking everything that agrees with them and applying it to it, but then completely hiding everything that disagrees with them.
And that's very in line with the news at the moment around all the allegations of child abuse.
Or the independent inquiry into child sex abuse in Britain, that's quite a development, that is.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that if you've been reading into it?
Witnesses have certain policies when wrongdoing in the congregation has been reported.
Okay.
They very much believe in only acknowledging wrongdoing if there has been two witnesses to witness it. That's a two-witness rule. But of course, in most cases of sexual abuse, even child sexual abuse, there is no two witnesses. There's just the perpetrator and the victim.
Right.
So these cases are very much not reviewed. They are hidden. They are not reported. And of course, that's what's led to where we are now.
So in the UK at the moment, there are people coming forward with allegations that they were exposed to and abused within the church.
Most definitely, yes.
And
Even myself have been through strange circumstances of a sexual nature with the elders that have not quite warranted what they did to me. It's a very emotional thing because, as a young person, of course, we all have needs and we all have feelings, and these feelings are natural. But when you repress them to the extent that the witnesses do, and you enforce punishment for feeling certain ways, you're bound to have problems, you're bound to have uncomfortable conversations, meetups, Bible bashing, and of course, all this is done secretly with no witnesses.
Do you think that the abuse that is being alleged against the Jehovah's Witnesses, not just in the UK but worldwide at the moment, do you think that the abusers are generally those who are in positions of power?
Oh, that's a good question. If they are in a position of power, like an elder or something, they definitely have sway. And I have read lots and lots of examples and experiences where elders have misused their positions of trust. And even with me, I feel that I had been betrayed when I confessed myself. And all this information was shared not just around the elders, but around congregations as well.
Did you expect to feel a level of relief upon confessing your sexuality to the elders?
Sorry, what did you say then?
Did you expect to feel some level of, did you expect for there to feel as though a weight had been lifted when you confessed your sexuality to the elders?
We're taught that for wrongdoing or wrong feelings, they can be controlled or put in the right place. And even if these feelings are quite dominant or quite pervasive, God can help you be straight, be normal, or think normal, or think the way the organization wants you to think. But that's only possible if you confess to the elders and follow their direction. So you are pretty much forced to confide with the elders if you want to fix who you are, which is a bit odd to say.
And did you feel initially that that had helped anything at all by confessing to them?
I think it, to be honest, I think it made things worse. I thought I'd confess to them. And then for them to help me show a bit of understanding, but instead all I got was weekly visits, which were very Gestapo-like, where two elders would take me in a van in the middle of nowhere to have very uncomfortable conversations. Oh yeah, still on my own, like.
And
And
what age was this roughly?
13 onwards.
That's horrific. That's terrifying, especially because those two people, I'm guessing, are people that you
Don't know.
think are approachable or people who are supposed to take care of their flock, so to speak.
No, they weren't those kind of people.
That's absolutely terrifying. I can't imagine how scary that must be, especially on your own.
The stuff that they talk about and ask you certain questions, like, what did you do, or how did that make you feel, or what were you looking at, and it's not pleasant at all. And to
It
have these twice a week.
almost sounds as if they enjoyed the conversations they were having with you. Like they may have their own repressed sexuality.
Oh, most definitely. They've even talked about their own sexualities quite often with me as well.
What,
And
as
some
in
were.
examples on how to be or how not to be, and this is what they did before the Jehovah's
Yeah.
Witnesses, and this is how they've been saved, those types of conversations.
Those kind of conversations, yeah.
But they talk about them as though they're reliving those experiences and actually quite enjoyed them.
I was talking to one elder about, of course, giving in to temptation and such, and he was saying, "Oh, I used to be just like you, and even now I struggle with it." And he was telling me a story how he went into a bookshop recently, and he looked at a photography book with a few nude pictures in there, and how he berated himself after that. And I just thought, what level of extent or to.
And how appropriate is that to talk to with a, a young teenager?
The repression inside the organization is quite immense. And as I said, I think that leads to a lot of problems.
Yeah. It sounds from the interviews and the testimonies I've looked at and I've listened to, it sounds as though the abuse, especially the abuse towards children, and young people and vulnerable people, comes from a lot of it comes from that repressed sexuality within the Jehovah's Witnesses. And obviously I can't say for sure that that's what it is. That's purely my speculation, which I don't do very often. But from what I have gathered in evidence, that appears to be where the roads lead.
But it has been described as a paedophile's paradise because, of course, you can do what you want and not get penalised for it. And not only would you not get penalised for it, but even if the victim were to report it, they're not going to believe you. And even if they do believe you, they're not going to call the authorities on it because apparently it looks bad on the organisation.
Yes, and I know that in a lot of congregations, the elders have a lot of influence on families outside of the church as well. So it might be common for you to invite the elders round for dinner, and their wives round for dinner on a night where you're not going to the Kingdom Hall, to, you know, offer them your appreciation and your respect for everything that they do for you and your congregation. And then, you know, it's access to the family, it's access to the children, and the parents have unconditional trust in these elders, because again, they are the positions of power within the majority of the congregations across the world. So unfortunately, it appears that the unrequited respect and trust that comes with being an elder is hugely abused throughout the entire movement. Which is just, it's just sad, and it's unfortunate, because it seems to be happening everywhere. These news stories are coming out from all the corners of the world right now, and hopefully in the coming months we'll see more people coming forward to speak out against the Jehovah's Witnesses, and hopefully we'll see some positive change. I'm not saying that the entire religion is corrupt or that the entire root of the religion is evil. There just seems to be a lot of evil things happening within the Jehovah's Witnesses that are finally coming to light.
For me, I'm pretty open to believing what you want to believe. I think that's a given human right. You're allowed to believe or be mm-hmm. who you want to be. Mm-hmm. The problem is when you try to enforce on others, and the Witnesses very much do that.
Well, it does appear so when you go pioneering and then your name is put in on some list.
Oh, yeah.
So talk us through that a little bit as well.
The organisation does have a lot of information gathering, some not really much legal. And I'm only privileged to this because I used to be the literature assistant. Before, I think it was 2015, we had slips of pieces of paper. They had a unique documenting code, whether it was a PK60 or something, whatever. These little small slips were to be filled out when you had knocked on somebody's house and they showed interest. They'd list down the person's name, age, sex, who they were, their address, how to contact them, but also what they talked about, if they had any problems or any anxieties, or if they were going through a bereavement. Anything about them, as much information as you can, because of course they would be then targeted to be visited again with a more custom approach.
So data is being collected almost from the door-to-door visits, and it's being held without the knowledge of the owner's permission.
Oh yeah, definitely. And since this this new law restricting the collection of personal information has been enacted, we got rid of all those slips.
Okay.
Me and the assistants, we used to burn them, which is a common thing for witnesses to do. If something falls out of the laws of legality, we burn them. But then again, the oral instruction was to still take notes, but personal notes. So instead of an organizational arrangement, it's now gone down to a personal thing. So yes, witnesses who contact you at your door will write everything and anything they can about you.
And what if I was to move house?
If you are within the organisation, they will follow you. They will keep tabs on you and where you are, because they feel it's their spiritual duty to care for you. Even if you don't want anything to do with the organisation. I mean, even now, I haven't told the elders where I live, but they still knock on my door. I had one knock on my door today, actually, this morning.
I've got a question to talk about all that stuff that you emailed me about a few weeks ago. When we talk about Jehovah's Witnesses, I think I've mentioned this before. I am atheist, So if I do get somebody knock on my door or approach me in the street and want to talk to me about the Word of God, or a specific Bible interpretation that they'd like to talk to me about, I'm very quick to say, you know, no thanks. And, you know, I don't want to be approached by a strange religious person.
Not interested.
That's my personal view. But I think it's really important for us to just have a quick conversation about how those people are almost, not always, I'm not saying this is universal across all religions, but those people are in situations like the one that you were in, very difficult ones where they think they are doing the right thing. They genuinely think they are doing the work of Jehovah or the work of their chosen God or whichever religion they follow. So people are so quick to judge followers of religion, but it's a very delicately and meticulously carried out formula to get these people further and further and further indoctrinated and further believing what they are being taught. So when you're going from door to door and you're pioneering, you genuinely think that you are doing what you need to do to be saved.
Oh, yes. So I'm saying witnesses can't really be blamed for what they do because their faith is absolute. They do believe this is the truth.
Yes.
And this is how to save people. So instead of blaming the witnesses, you really need to start blaming, you know, who's fed them these ideas. Yes.
They genuinely do care for people and they are genuinely trying to save people.
Yeah, exactly. They are genuine people and a lot of them are very happy. I say very happy. A lot of them are very nice people. But yeah.
You also mentioned during our exchange something about a spiritual burnout. Is this something that you've encountered?
Spiritual burnout is the organization's way of belittling an emotional breakdown.
Right.
Of course, unsustainable lifestyles mixed with unreasonable standards. A lot of witnesses have poverty or feelings of guilt, coupled with an environment of snitching, belittlement, and enforced expectation does lead a lot of people to have emotional breakdowns.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when a person is experiencing emotional breakdown, they belittle it by calling it spiritual burnout. You know, the elders come round and talk about it and talk about how you feel, and pretty much the cure-all answer is just to do more for the organization, which is a bit stupid. I myself have had a breakdown in the organization because I was doing too much, and I had to me was a couple of elders tell me to do more.
Right. Okay. And did this come hand in hand with you being expected to financially donate to the church?
Yeah, this is awkward. This is, as witnesses, we all are expected to give towards the cause.
Okay.
Especially our valuable things. And if not your valuable things, then your time. So we're taught that everything comes from God or comes from Jehovah, that he sustains us, and that he only rewards the generous of us. So a popular teaching of the witnesses is the example of the widow's mite inside the Bible, where this account shows this poor, lonely widow donating two small coins. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of this before.
Yes, Casey. Yeah, the other two people I've interviewed have both separately mentioned the story of the lady with the last two coins and she donated them anyway.
Yes, now you see, with the witnesses, the emphasis isn't on how little she gave. The emphasis is that she gave everything. So even if you are a well-off brother,
right,
you are expected to give more. You see, it's not that she gave two small coins, it's that she gave her all.
So if you were a millionaire, you're not expected to give two coins. You're expected to give your all.
To give your all as much as you can.
Right.
There's no middle ground. It reminds me of because it's very much seen as a form of worship. You give something to God. You're giving back to Him. That's worship. And donating certainly does give you that that option to do so. Amongst my conversations with a few elders, I think it was encouraged by one of the elders to donate money every time I had a wrong thought or I gave in to temptation. And this was supposed to be a lesson to discourage me or discourage that train of thought. That was £100 every time I relapsed,
right,
which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think within 2 weeks, I had lost all my savings.
So what age were you when you got your first job?
I was 16.
And were you expected to then donate part of your wages to the church?
Unofficially, yes.
Okay, and did you go ahead with this, or did you keep your money for yourself? Because 16 with your first job, that's a big deal.
Well, moving out at 16 and then getting my first job at 16, all in the name of pursuing spiritual things. You know, I'd left my family, I left all my friends at school, I adopted this new lifestyle and I needed to support myself. I moved in with witnesses who weren't my family but were my new family, and I had to earn rent. I had to do everything except apart from their rates are quite extortionate, unfortunately.
And you mentioned before about consequences, and then we spoke a little bit about being disfellowshipped. Can you give me any other examples about why a person might be disfellowshipped from the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Right. Again, this is another major issue with what you can be disfellowshipped and what you can't be disfellowshipped within the Kingdom Hall.
Okay.
I think it's just important to stress that you can be punished or removed from any congregational setting for anything, because when the elders review a case of wrongdoing, or they think you've done something wrong, they don't look at what you've done, but they more look at your attitude. So
Right. Whether
you're repentant, sorry, or whether you will make amends or play their humiliation game or put them on restriction, it's all to do with something. If you've done something out of line and you refuse to correct yourself, you'd only be hurting yourself. You see kind of how they work? I mean, if you'd done something and you weren't sorry that you'd done it, you could first be marked, you could then go to a judicial committee, you can have restrictions, disassociation, disfellowshipping, apostasy. It's all dependent on the person's attitude. So even if something as little as dressing immodestly within the congregation, which is relative, of course, to regional expectations and social standards. But if you refuse to take the counsel, then that can result from a removal of the congregation if it poses a threat to the rest of the congregation.
Right.
So not the sin, it's the attitude of the individual, which means pretty much anything you can get counseled on.
So you can be disfellowshipped for is it under the discretion of the elders then?
Yes.
It's not completely set in stone what can and cannot get you disfellowshipped.
No, it's not okay. Set in stone. It's about the attitude of the person.
Right. Okay. And I've heard from a few others that there is exclusive language used within the Jehovah's Witnesses that might go straight over my head, for example, because I'm not a practicing Jehovah's Witness. Is there any examples of this language that you can give me?
There's a lot, and you get used to using it every single day. It doesn't even cross your mind. Of course, one of the most common ones is calling the religion the truth.
Right.
That's just a given, that is. The organization is the truth. You'll ask if a person's in the truth. It's just the same as asking if the person's in the organization. And of course, that has a big mental effect on people when they try to leave or they try and reason out of the organization, because they know it as the truth. Simple things like that.
And why is it that you decided to leave? When and why did you finally decide to leave the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Well, the Witnesses teach that if you seek kingdom interests first, God will provide for you. Now, being 16 years old and moving out and getting a first job, I was very much dependent on that formula. I needed God to help me live my life. So I gave as much as I could to the organization. So I pioneered foreign language I went to foreign language, special foreign language assignments. I moved to a new greater area. I donated lots of money. I helped at conventions. I did as much as I can for the organization, even to the point of having spiritual burnout. But I was still poor. I was still in debt. I was still having problems. I couldn't understand it. I was suicidal because this lifestyle I was living was completely unsustainable. I just felt that God hated me. I felt very much alone and isolated. It was only when I had an invitation from my sister to move out of that area and to live with her that I started to distance myself from the organization.
And what was your congregation's reaction to you distancing yourself?
They advised me not to go. They advised me that moving in with my sister or leaving the congregation would have adverse effects, that it would damage my spirituality, that I won't be fully putting my trust in God. And it was only
And
after I left, I had a meeting with my previous elders who told me that they were looking to disfellowship me for it.
Those things that you were threatened with when you started to distance yourself, have any of those things actually happened?
Oh, yes. Of course, after moving from the area, and after going through several bouts of, well, a heavy bout of depression, and soul searching and such, I decided to look into the Jehovah's Witnesses a bit more in depth. I think my main argument against the Witnesses is, of course, the teaching of evolution, which is something I've become quite adept with. I try to raise my concerns with the other witnesses. They either wouldn't believe me, but some of them pursued it higher, and now I'm being done for apostasy charges at the moment.
Yes, so sorry, just to go back and talk the listeners through this. You emailed me a couple of weeks ago about an incident that happened where you're living. Just talk us through what your housemate came to tell you, and then what's happened about that since.
So, I've had a few conversations with my new elders and my new congregation about some of the concerns I've had with our practices and our beliefs, which of course has raised a few flags with them. So they've been desperately trying to get in touch with me, but unfortunately I work nights, so I don't really answer the phone during the day. So I've actually had one elder camp outside my house for I don't know how long he was there. I didn't even know he was there, but because I live in a flat accommodation with a lot of shared space, as it were, he had obviously waited out there for one of my neighbours to come through the door so he can get through to hand me a letter. We're in the middle of a pandemic, don't forget, and this elder had gone through so much just to camp outside my flat to wait for one of my neighbors to open the front door for him to get in, for him to knock on my door and to give me by hand a letter just inviting me to a meeting with them. It's my neighbor, personally, or housemate, was pretty disturbed by the fact that they had sat out there watching me or watching when I'd come out. I didn't know they were there.
Absolutely, yeah. And you mentioned that we're in the middle of a global pandemic. I know that I'm over in England and you're in Wales, and Wales lifted their restrictions very slowly compared to the rest of the world. Things remained in lockdown over in Wales, and further restrictions and precautions were put in place, stricter than I think over in here in England.
Yes, at the time we were under massive restriction. We were.
And he was just camping outside your.
Yeah, I don't know how long he was there for. I didn't know he was there.
I'm just going to get up the photo you sent me so that I can read exactly what the letter said, because when you emailed it to me, I was very worried about what would happen to you. Obviously, we're talking now, so everything is okay, but it's probably one of the most cultish experiences I've come across. Somebody camping outside your door to deliver you a letter that said, "Dear Luke, we have tried on several occasions, unfortunately, without success, to speak to you. So would now like to give you the following information by letter. One, we would like to give you a written invitation to attend a judicial hearing. Two, the alleged course of action is that of, quote, spreading false teaching and undermining the confidence of the Brothers in Jehovah's arrangement. And three, the time and place for the hearing is the Kingdom Hall on this date and time. So you were given this letter, which judicial hearing is, that's scary language because that sounds almost legally binding.
I'm not a bad person. I haven't done anything wrong. All I've done is looked beyond the organisation and started studying at university. That's all I've done. And because I've raised a few concerns, I'm being called to a judicial hearing.
And judicial, when they say judicial within the Jehovah's Witnesses, is this legally binding or not?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't concern the legalities of the country you're in.
Because when it says judicial, that's what comes to my mind. So it's scary to receive something like that. It's almost like when you get a letter through the door saying, if you don't pay this bill within this amount of time, you will be fined in big red letters. That's almost how it felt for me when I read that letter. And then, of course, you did actually go in good faith to this meeting.
Yeah, I went with good faith, purely because I know the game that they're playing. Now, 9 times out of 10, when a judicial committee is called on, they've already decided what they're going to do. Okay, so I've already talked to these elders about my doubts about the organisation, about some of the evidences that I find, which pretty much show that the governing body or that their organisation can't be right. So they have me down on apostasy charges, which is, of course, what you've just read there about spreading distrust or sowing mistrust within the organisation, even though I've never really spoken to anyone but the elders.
And even if you were to go, for example, I know that the XJW subreddit is a place that a lot of people will go to for support and to share their stories. If you were to even go on there and share your story, for anybody to link that back to you, that would be seen as a worldly activity anyway, surely.
Yes. So joining forums like that filled with other people who think against the organisation is strictly prohibited.
So even if you were to spread your experiences and your distrust and your and moving away from the religion itself, if somebody was to come across that and say, well, we've seen you on the internet spreading this message, they've committed the same crime almost by going and doing the same thing.
They obviously, and it is well known that they have a department either at Bethel or some appointed brothers to keep an eye out for other brothers who have gone rogue. And I think they do surf these sites quite regularly, looking for people who have either divulged information about the organisation, which puts them in a negative light, or have gone fully against the organisation. You can see this in such examples with John Cedars and his Pillowgate rebuttal on YouTube, or other kind of channels who openly talk about Jehovah's Witnesses and how quickly the Witnesses react to that. They obviously do keep an eye out on people and what they're doing.
Which, in my mind, if you're going to ask a member of the religion to sit at a computer all day and track down people who are speaking against the church, that to me just seems like as worldly as the people who were spreading these messages in the first place.
Yeah, they used to have they used to have a policy where you could actually write into the branch office and they'll answer any questions that you have. And I personally took advantage of this. I wrote a letter, as well as a report on a lot of things that I found. But I think that arrangement has been disbanded now. So instead of having you write into them, they are now actively looking for you.
Okay. And then you have an elder on your doorstep waiting to hand you a letter about a judicial hearing.
As I said, 9 times out of 10, they've already decided what to do. I know that because I've been on a few judicial committees before. Not um, not on the judging side, but being sat before them. I was on a judicial committee for serious sin, I think, when I was 14.
And what is serious sin?
They have a very distinct classification of sin, Jehovah's Witnesses. They say that some sin is worse than other sins. So things like overeating could be considered a serious sin. Smoking, serious sin, or any kind of sexual conduct could be a serious sin.
Okay, okay. And you went to this meeting in good faith, and you went with your younger brother, is that right?
I knew the game that they were playing. As I said, 9 times out of 10, they have already made their decision. They want to get rid of. They want to get rid of me, and to do that, they need to disfellowship me.
Yep.
And of course, doing that, I lose everyone and everything.
Yeah.
So I was determined to make a stand, to show that I'm not lying for what I'm doing, and I shouldn't be punished for it. Mm-hmm. Now, there are different ways a person can be disfellowshipped. You can be disassociated, disfellowshipped, or apostatized.
Right.
Now, there are slight differences to these words that the witnesses use. Of course, to be disfellowshipped means that you have been kicked out of the organization.
Yeah.
To be disassociated means that you have chosen not to be in the organization.
Yeah.
They both contain the same, they're exactly the same apart from the words that they use to have them for. Right. Now, they invited me to this meeting. If I chose not to attend, then they would take that as proof of disassociation. And everybody would be told that I have chosen this way of life, when really I've been kicked out.
Okay.
So I wasn't going to give them the satisfaction to say that I left willingly. If I'm going to be kicked out, I'm going to be kicked out. So I went to this meeting to prove that I have done nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. On the one condition that I have a witness with me. Because there are three brothers against one. So there's three elders against me. Mm-hmm. They haven't divulged any of the information which is usual for a legal trial, like the accusations or evidences of or witnesses against me. But as I said, they've already made their mind up. So me going there out of good faith was just to prove a point.
So they wouldn't sit down and talk with you, though. They refused to have the meeting because you wanted to take a witness in with you.
We were there for 2 hours just debating whether a witness was allowed or not. And I knew that in circumstances pertaining to a judicial committee, I was allowed to have a witness. It has that in their little elder handbook, but they still refused us to go in.
So as of this moment, you're kind of still in limbo with your status within the witnesses?
As I said, I had a witness contact me this morning.
Yes.
He knocked on my door. He gave me a letter and they shut off.
And what does the letter say?
Hi, Luke. We have tried on several occasions again to contact you, unfortunately without success. It is important that we state clearly that it is a requirement that you meet alone with the judicial committee. Therefore, we would like to once again invite you to attend a judicial hearing. Date and time.
So, are you going to agree to this meeting?
This is a tennis game. I told them that if they were going to adjourn it or call it again, I'm still going to come to make the point that I've done nothing wrong, but I will always bring a witness.
Yes, and I think that is reasonable given the headlines that are in the news currently.
Well, unbeknownst to them, because it is quite a sensitive subject, I am making recordings. And what they're trying to do to me is completely unreasonable. Mm-hmm. It's not fair on me, especially with the what's at stake. Mm-hmm. How they're treating me. I mean, just how they're hounding me. I mean, I haven't been to a meeting in 4 years. Why now? Why suddenly interested in me?
It definitely comes across as harassment. As you said, somebody during a global pandemic was sitting on your doorstep. Not only does that affect you, but it affects the people that live, you know, in that housing complex. You have them sending you letters using threatening language, like judicial hearing. They're refusing to see you with a witness, which you are completely entitled to. They want to see you in a room on your own with a group of them and you on your own individually. They haven't given you exactly what they want to talk to you about, and they are coming to you saying that you have been apostatizing and you know, all these things, that you, just because you have taken a step back from the movement. So I you know, I'm obviously keep in touch to hear where this story goes, but it does make me worry about your well-being. It almost seems like nobody knows what's going to happen next. What lengths are they going to go to? Because it seems so far that they've been pretty dramatic with trying to get you alone.
I haven't opened my front curtains in 3 years. They don't know I'm in.
So you've had this harassment since you've left, but in terms of your spirituality, in terms of your confidence, your mental health, your feelings of guilt, how has life been since you've decided to take this step back?
It's got better.
Yeah.
It's got better. At first, it was pretty black, because, of course, what the witnesses want you to believe is that there is no life outside the organisation. There is no purpose. So having to take a step back from all that, it felt not only that I'd lost everything, but also that I had nothing to live for.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very dark time, but only after researching the organisation and learning that they aren't the true religion, that I finally started to get better and to heal.
And do you still find yourself sometimes having those feelings of guilt and shame that were ingrained in you whilst you were actively practicing?
There's a lot of things and practices, or even thought processes, which I'm still trying to get rid of, that the organisation has, I've done hard to indoctrinate inside me. Even simple things with the company that I keep, or the words that I use, or it's hard to explain unless you have been in that level of thought control.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke about your suffering with your mental health before. Do you feel like you're in a better place now with in terms of your depression?
Oh yes. My depression was solely caused by my environment, what I was doing, and the people I was around. I've healed in a lot of ways since I left the organization, to realize that it was actually the organization that was causing me harm. Mm-hmm.
It's such a relief to hear that mentally you're feeling stronger and that you've managed to do some healing. I know it's not easy for everybody coming out of these situations to have that kind of breakthrough that you've had, which is fantastic considering the amount of pressure that you're still receiving from the church.
It never leaves you. It never leaves you. And I think once you've been indoctrinated in that way, you're probably going to spend the rest of your life either battling negative thoughts or feelings of guilt, or even just the way you think.
And what types of things did you do on your or even still on your journey of healing?
It's very difficult. I mean, the JW Reddit has been quite good, because there I can see I'm not alone the way I think and feel, and people with similar experiences, which is a big relief to me. But also just trying to be true to yourself. I mean, I've always wanted to live as an honest person, and living honestly does help. That's all I've ever wanted in life, and even if that means leaving this organisation, then I will.
And is there any other advice that you could give people that are looking to leave their own congregation or their own cult or their own movement, whether it's Jehovah's Witnesses or not?
I think to doubt. I think doubt is quite a refining quality. It should never be belittled or locked away or censored. Otherwise, how would you know if it is the truth? I mean, as a witness, you're told not to test the organization or to test God, and to never question their authority or position. but that's just a control tactic. That's only ever used by people who want to hide what they really are. I mean, if it is the truth, then you don't have to fear doubting it, because truth is always absolute. Don't deny doubt. Never deny doubt.
And during this, I mean, we've spoken a little bit about the pandemic that we're experiencing at the moment. I've had differing opinions on how the pandemic will have affected things like the Jehovah's Witnesses. Some people have said it's going to ramp up the numbers because people are going to become more worried about the end times. Others have said that it is going to lower the numbers because there's less pioneering, there's less door to door, there's less donations coming in. What are your thoughts and feelings around the effect that COVID has had on things like the Jehovah's Witnesses?
I think it's had both positive and negative effects towards the organization. I'd say positive towards the organization because they're really playing on the thought that this is the end times and using this COVID pandemic as an excuse to try and say that we are in the last days. And this has led a lot of witnesses to mass panic. Even witnesses who have left the organization are panicking to come back in, sadly, because I don't know why. I mean, we can expect pandemics. They come round quite regularly. This one was overdue, but the witnesses are really playing on the fear factor that this is the end. But then again, it has also affected the witnesses negatively, in that for a short while they weren't allowed to convene regularly at meetings or at places of worship. And maybe that bit of space has given some doubting witnesses time to think freely.
That's definitely what I've been hoping for. I ask this question during every interview at the moment, and I'm always hoping that somebody will say, yes, they are using the pandemic to further their agenda, but also members of the congregation have had, a chance to step back and say, well, hang on a minute, I want to enjoy a glass of wine with my meal, maybe the occasional cigarette, and know that I'm not going to be punished for it in the ways that the elders would like us to believe.
One of the biggest controls the organization use, or control tactics, is just to keep their members busy. If you keep them busy, they can't think straight. So, as I said, the average week for the witnesses is hectic anyway. You're always doing a lot. And even if there's nothing going on, you've still got a lot to do. But hopefully, this pandemic has given that breathing space where people can now start thinking clearly.
Well, we can only hope. I mean, I do ask this question, and I am actually speaking to somebody in a week or so's time who has recently left the movement that she was in purely because of the cognitive dissonance that she has gained during this pandemic. So there is living proof there that it's having that effect in some places. So let's just hope that it's more common than we think. One last question I have before I'm finished, before I offer you a chance to add anything you think we might have missed. You mentioned before that your other siblings weren't invested like your older brother in the Jehovah's Witnesses. So what is your relationship like now with them, and do you still have the opportunity to speak to your older brother, and where do you stand with him?
My sisters who left the organization when they were very young, one of them struggles quite mentally with thoughts of abandonment from the organization. She finds it very hard and she suffers from overwhelming feelings of guilt and fear that the world's sometime going to end soon. So it's, dare I say, it screwed her up pretty bad. My other sisters are a lot more reasonable. I do like talking to them, especially this one, so she's been very, very supportive because she's not religiously inclined neither. But as to all the other family members who are still in the organisation, for now we've agreed to disagree, which is a general thing witnesses do. But as soon as this judicial committee has come to their conclusion, then I'm pretty sure they'd have to fall into what is expected of them and to cut me off.
That's such a devastating thing. I can't imagine how difficult that decision must be for you to choose between staying somewhere that gives you, quote, spiritual burnout and affects your mental health so negatively, or choosing your family instead and being able to have them in your lives and them being able to have contact with you when they wish. I had the same conversation with somebody I interviewed last week, and it just seems absolutely devastating to have to make this decision. It's
Personally,
almost like you
that,
have to choose yourself or them, and obviously you should always choose yourself, but it's not as black and white as that.
yeah. No, personally, that's why I've been quiet about it for the past 2 years.
So that's all the questions that I have. I don't know if there's anything you think we've missed, Luke, or anything you'd like to add.
I thought I'll add just the extent. I'd always want to emphasize the extent witnesses are willing to disassociate people and to never contact them again. I mean, their disfellowshipping arrangement is absolute. If someone is disfellowshipped, you do not talk to them. Now, when I was in the Kingdom Hall growing up as a young person, there was also a young person who grew up with me. He's a very nice young lad. We did all sorts of things together. We got into trouble together. We did special projects together. We were in the ministry together all the time. There was no other young ones in the hall, so we got on really well. We were best friends. We were the bestest friends. But at the moment, he's not even keeping in contact with me. In fact, it was only 2 days ago he got married. Not even told me.
That's such a shame.
It
That's
was
so
such a
sad.
shame. It was such a shame because I was actually planned or arranged to be his best man.
That's so, Luke, that's so sad.
I'm not even disfellowshipped at the moment, but because word has got out that I have doubts or that I have contradicting thoughts, the amount of shunning that you go through and the abandonment you go through with this organization is absolutely mental.
I mean, it's probably not a far reach to suggest that he probably still even wanted you there, but he wouldn't be able to because of how he would then be received by everybody and his wife and their and everybody. You know, even though you haven't been disfellowshipped, I can't imagine how difficult it would be for him and the reception that he would get if he was to still interact with you.
I don't know. I mean, to have me there would be nice, but just to let me know, I mean, no doubt we're still best friends, but there is this divide that the organization has put between us because I disagree with their leaders.
Hopefully there'll be an opportunity for you two to still maintain a friendship, whatever the outcome of your journey is with the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's just extremely important that you think about the milestones that you have achieved in your recovery from this movement and make sure that you realize that as devastating as it can be to lose friends and family, your personal journey is you're becoming so strong and you're recovering so well. And I just really hope that things continue to get better for you, Luke.
Yeah, I hope so too.
I really do. And I'm glad that you've managed to move into a place, I'm guessing, has non-practicing members of society living so you can interact with worldly people.
You know what? They are the best kind of people because they're just like us.
Fantastic. That's good. That makes me smile as well, Luke. I've finished all of my questions. So if you've finished as well, that's probably where I'm going to end the session today.
Okie
Fantastic. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Luke. I'm really looking forward to being able to share your story with our listeners and just give a further platform for people to share their experiences and actually have their voices and their stories heard. So thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me today, Luke. I really hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you so much, Casey.
That is the end of this week's episode. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do so by emailing me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or find me on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, and this has been the Cult Vault.